This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 18th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet on the Opera Grounds. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
Always good to do this. Great to be doing another opera show this year.
It's amazing where the time goes. We just finished the last one.
I know. Well, today we're talking about an opera called La Fanciulla del West, or The Girl of the West, by Giacomo Puccini. And this is just so interesting to me. I mean, I'm just learning every year like a novice about opera, but the idea that Puccini, who is this super famous master of Italian opera, was aware of and writing about and fascinated by the American West during the Gold Rush era. Who knew?
Yeah, how did he come to that? He was always very far-reaching in his topics, I must say. I mean, La Bohème is set in Paris. This is set in the Sierra Nevadas in California. Turandot is set in China. He looked far afield for sources. Part of it was because he was fascinated by the work of a playwright called David Belasco. Belasco was an American who, born to British parents, who was raised in the gold mining region, actually, of California. And this young man, as a young person, had a touring company that went to the camps, can you imagine, to the gold mining camps, playing theater plays. So he learned. Belasco knew what this was all about. And then his career gradually improved, and he ended up in New York as an impresario. He actually had a theater built for him on 44th Street and insisted that he have a suite, an entire floor built above the theater for himself, which happened. And that theater is still functioning. You can still go to the Belasco in New York. The first interaction he had with Puccini was when Puccini saw his Madame Butterfly. He saw that in London, I think, and was fascinated by the piece, which is interesting because Puccini spoke no English. And, of course, Belasco was writing in English about this Japanese girl in this context. But Belasco was an incredible stager of theater. He knew how to work the stage and how to work theater. And he had this amazing scene in the middle of Madame Butterfly where she stood for 15 minutes. It's now the famous humming chorus in Madame Butterfly, where she just stands at the end of the evening waiting for Pinkerton's return. And she stands through the night overlooking Nagasaki Harbor and through the night and into the following morning. The actress just stood, and the whole thing was done with stage effects. Puccini was so blown away by this that he went backstage and he said, I want to make an opera about this. And then soon afterwards, this was the next one, he saw Belasco's Girl of the Golden West, which is how it was presented on Broadway. And when he saw the piece, apparently rushed backstage, threw his arms around Belasco's neck and said, I have to have it. What do I have to do? And Belasco said, what do you do with an Italian composer with tears in his eyes begging for your play? You give it to him. So that's how it sort of started. Though Belasco stayed on board throughout the whole process. This was 1907. The opera premiered at the Metropolitan Opera in New York in 3 years later, 1910. And Belasco actually became what we would call the director of the first performance, which was unusual because at this time there was really no such thing as directors. There were singers and composers and conductors. The conductors sort of held the whole thing together, not a director as we do today. But he knew how to direct. So he worked with Caruso, who sang the lead, with Aimé Destin. And apparently they had a wonderfully collegiate interaction, the lead characters, with Belasco, who was the first director, if you like.
One of the things I want to ask you about that, I mean, this is over 100 years ago, and the staging and sort of theatricality of opera has evolved a great deal since then. What do we know about that production? Were they acting, or was it more like that kind of, you know,
stand and deliver is what we
call
it.
Stand and deliver, yes. Park and bark.
Park and bark. They would come on stage. I mean, I was reared on opera like this in Ireland as a child. There would be sort of, Madame Butterfly would be 5 foot square, tall and wide. She would get on stage. She would set her eyes on the conductor and never interact with the singer. It was, you really had to suspend all belief.
But you would think with Belasco directing that it might be a little bit more theatrical.
Yes, he turned that around. And that was one of the great, I suppose, a turning point in a way for opera, especially with the chorus. The chorus would tend to come on, stand in lines, and just sing at the conductor with no interaction, no sense of character. And today, I must say, last year when we did Cold Mountain, I watched the director work with each and every member of the chorus. Each one has a backstory. You never hear about it. You never know. But they've been given a persona and a character. This is also now done, of course, with La Fanciulla. All the minors have their own story. And in a way, it's a sort of an ensemble opera in that there are many of the minors whom we get to know as individuals. We get to know where they're coming from, what their hopes and fears are, and their craziness, because they're very well developed. That's one of the great things about this opera. It's not a straight, you know, aria, recitative, conversation aria. It's sung through. The music goes straight through. In fact, it's a bit hard to applaud throughout the thing, because there's no end of an aria where you applaud, which makes much more sense, and which is how opera is presented today. It's sung through, as we call, without pauses, at the end of an aria.
Just as you wouldn't clap in the middle of a theatrical performance of a regular play.
No, you're right. I suppose I've never seen Hamlet's To Be or Not To Be with a wild applause right. At the end. I mean, it breaks the dramatic mood, of course.
Yeah.
And you can maintain that now. And Puccini knew this. Puccini was an amazing man of theater. Even though he took on this Wild West spaghetti Western, if you like, speaking no English. And there's English in this. I mean, when the leading lady comes on, they all say, hello, Minnie. It's in English.
He probably knew that. That much English.
Yeah, but the Camptown races are in there and all sorts of little English expressions that had to come via Belasco. But he worked it into the piece and it works.
Shall we listen to some music?
Yeah, let's listen to the opening of this opera. It's about the Sierra Nevadas. He's writing about place and space and the extraordinary beauty of California in the Sierra Nevadas, in this setting in Cloudy Mountain, where the whole action takes place in the Polka Saloon. So let's hear just the opening of the opera and listen for a sense of the grandeur of nature that Puccini brings into this opening.
That was the grand intro to La Fanciulla del West, Girl of the Golden West by Puccini. So let's talk about some of the characters who are in this, because I have to say it's one of those operas I think you're going to just fall in love with the different characters.
Yeah, you do. The three lead characters are a bar girl, a sheriff, and a bandit. You're starting there. It's classic.
Yeah.
But in this next section I'd like to play for you, it's one of the minors. The minors are very well depicted in this opera. The first one is Jake Wallace, who sings this sort of ballad about Old Dog Tray. This was a camp minstrel who went from camp to camp in the 49ers, the 1849ers, the 1850s, when the gold rush was at its height. And he gives voice to the nostalgia and the loneliness of these men. They're a pretty wild bunch. They've come from all over the world. They're seeking gold. Many of them find it, but many of them lose it. They lose it on the gambling tables, and they go crazy. I mean, some of them never make it out of there.
Yeah.
Some were astute and got rich. But Jake Wallace was for real. He was a camp minstrel, played a banjo, and went from camp to camp. At the end of his song, which sort of momentarily pauses the miners who've all come bursting into the polka salon. It's the end of the day. They want a drink. They're going to get their whiskey so that they can toast Minnie when she shows up. And they go straight to the gambling table. So he comes in, and there's a sad moment here in this excerpt with Jake Wallace. At the end of that, another man breaks down. He can't bear the loneliness of the whole thing, so the men pass the hat and they collect enough money to send him on his way so that he'll be able to go back home, an option most of them don't have. And there's another character. They get into a card game and somebody cheats, and the cheater is accused. They're going to string him up. His name is Sidney Duck. Sidney Duck actually existed. Sidney Duck was part of a group of Australian miners who spent their lives not looking for gold but stealing the miners' gold. So all these little anecdotal pieces all fit into this, but the theme that you hear in this particular excerpt from Jake Wallace, the camp minstrel, really expresses the nostalgia, the loneliness of these men. And it's a theme that plays right the way through the opera and really comes to the fore at the very end of the opera. It keeps coming back. So let's listen to that.
That was, well, you heard at the beginning a little reference to Camp Town Ladies sing this song, Doodah. That was
Doodah, Doodah Day. Yes.
Right, Doodah yeah. Day. But this the rest of it that you heard was about Will, you know, a lonely miner singing, when I go home, if I make it home, will my mother remember me? Will my old dog Tray remember me? Mm-hmm. And it seems like a reference to the Odyssey, where Odysseus comes home after 20 years and his dog remembers
Absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely. You think classically, Mary Charlotte, that's very good. I don't know if Puccini thought that far back, but yes, old dog Tray.
Probably.
Actually, if you're away in those circumstances and you are thinking of home, I imagine your dog's pets are the first critters that come to mind that you miss, you know.
And who miss you.
Who miss you, exactly. So that's the opening. And then we get into the characters. We meet the leading characters. There's a Rance. This is the sheriff. He's standing by the bar. He's having a drink. He's impeccably turned out. He's a dangerous man. He's a gambler, and he can be pretty ruthless. The men are a little intimidated by him. He's a little apart. He fancies Minnie. Minnie is the proprietress of this wild polka saloon out in the middle of nowhere. She's been reared in this sort of lifestyle. And at this point, at the beginning, in this first act, they're in this set of a sort of a Quonset hut, it looks like. And in our production, it has a little electricity. There's a long bar, one of those long bars in the Westerns. They would slide the beer down the bar, right? It's exactly that. And Rance turns to her, and he tells her that he was attracted by gold, and gold has not let him down, but he is a loner. He's got an enormous diamond on his ring, and the men pay attention to him. He asks Minnie for a kiss. He says, "I'll give you $1,000 for a kiss." And she said, "No, I don't want $1,000, and my first kiss is yet to give." And then she responds to him with a little aria of her own that explains how she was reared in Mexico with her parents, her father who ran a bar, and her mother who helped. The mother would help at the gaming table. So she comes from that sort of background. It's a lovely contrast of the two leading characters, and it's the Puccini's way of introducing them in this piece.
Seguito, no, non rimpianto di poterla lasciare, nessuno mai amato, nessuno amato, nessuna casa.
So that introduces Rance, the sheriff, and Minnie, the bar girl, in La Fanciulla del West, the girl of the Golden West that the Santa Fe Opera will present this summer. The recording that we're playing today is a beautiful one. If you want to have this in your collection, a CD with the libretto, which is great because you can go through it ahead of time and know the story. The Minnie is Carol Neblett. Johnson, whom we are about to meet, is Placido Domingo, and Cheryl Milnes, whom we just heard here singing Rance, plays the role of Rance. The conductor is Zubin Mehta on Deutsche Grammophon. So now we have the final principal we need to meet, Dick Johnson.
Dick Johnson, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, absolutely. He arrives at the door, and the miners want nothing to do with the stranger. They'd rush rather push him back out into the cold and the snow. But Minnie recognizes him, and she said, "No, it's all right. Let him come in." Now, the opera cuts the backstory here, which is a bit of a pity. In Belasco, you know who Dick Johnson is, because Minnie has met him before. She's made one trip to Monterey, and when she was there, she met a very attractive Mexican caballero who they were attracted to each other, and he rode by her carriage, he gave her flowers, and they had a brief meeting, and then each went on their ways.
Dick Johnson, not his real name.
No, his real name is Ramirez, and he comes with a genealogy, a father who thought he was a Spanish grandee from Spain and lived accordingly. But then when things changed politically, he found himself cast out and became a bandit, a sort of a Robin Hood, And his son never knew about this. Ramirez's son knew nothing until his father was dying. On his deathbed, he says, I want you to continue my work. And the boy is horrified because he's now had a good education. Their mother is American. He passes for both an American and a Mexican, as we see in this opera. And he calls himself Dick Johnson from Sacramento. That's how he is introduced in the opera. But really, he's Ramirez. And this becomes immediately apparent when the Wells Fargo agent shows up in this bar and says, Ramirez, the bandit, has been seen, and we need to do something about him. And they all go rushing off to catch him, not knowing he's actually already in the bar.
Now, it is kind of an amazing story that a father, a bandit father, on his deathbed, who has sent his son to the best schools and got him a great education, says, son, my dying wish is that you become a bandit.
Exactly.
And carry on my work.
We're talking about opera, Mary Charlotte. You know, these things happen. Well, this was a very proud man. And actually, I would encourage people to go back, read the original play by David Belasco, because it gives you, you know about Johnson Ramirez when he shows up because you've had it from the play. You don't get in the opera. This man just shows up. And she speaks up for him. She says he's okay. He comes in. He has a drink. They have a dance. They had a system, apparently, in these bars and the gold mine camps where some of the men would just put on an armband denoting they were going to be girls for the waltzes so that they could dance together. Women were few and far between, of course, in these camps. They were predominantly male. There's a marvelous book by a woman called Louise Clapp called The Florence Letters. She was the wife of a doctor who actually lived in a gold mining camp in the Sierras at this time. And she reports how the lifestyle was. Puccini could have taken lines from her book in order to put into the opera. But she does describe the role of women. There were few prostitutes around. The women who were there apparently were highly respected by the men. They saw them so infrequently that, in fact, one miner asked a woman if he could pay her $10 just to have a few words with her daughter because he hadn't seen a child like his sister in so many years. It's actually quite touching the way they venerated women. Minnie herself, though she sounds like, you know, she's surviving this amazing situation, when she arrives and greets the miners, she takes the Bible off the shelf and sits down and says reads them a chapter from the Bible that says, there is no sinner who is so great that he cannot be redeemed, which is the line you all need to pay attention to because that's exactly what happens in the opera. But at this point, Johnson has arrived and he sings Too Many. He's taken aback when he sees her because he remembers this earlier meeting. He had come to rob the Polka Saloon of its gold, of course. But then
because he was a good daddy's boy who decided that he would, in fact,
Ramirez,
be a bandit.
Yes, that's exactly what he is. He has a whole band of greasers, which is how the Mexicans were described at the time. But he now doesn't want to do this because he's met Minnie and he backs off a bit, but he sings and tells her he has to leave, and she's a little disappointed. She says, oh, he doesn't like me. I've only $30 worth of education. He says, no, Minnie, no, you have the face of an angel. And it's a very sweet moment at the end of the first act where he picks up his saddle and he leaves, and she thinks it's because she's not good enough, though she did manage to get in an invitation to invite him to dinner at her cabin in the mountains that night before he leaves.
But just to clarify, she thinks she's not good enough, but he's escaping from the law.
Of course, he is a bandit, and he had come to rob her, but now he is not going to. He's going to leave. So he sings this little piece, and which I'll play for you, this short aria from the first act. If you think this sounds like music of the night from Phantom of the Opera, you're quite right. Andrew Lloyd Webber took this theme, this exact theme from this aria, and it became the music of the night. The Puccini estate were really furious about this, and he had to pay royally in order to be able to keep that piece of music in this famous musical. So if it rings a bell, not an operatic one, but a musical one, that's why. So let's hear Placido Domingo sing this aria.
Il mio petto vi sentì tremare.
And that is music from the opera The Girl of the Golden West, La Fanciulla del West, by Giacomo Puccini. And we just finished the first act, where our hero Dick Johnson has left the building. And where are we now?
Now, the second act opens in Minnie's cabin. She lives halfway up the mountain. Of course, there's a major storm. The snow is blowing outside. The set is of her little cabin. She has a companion, Wokley, who is an Indian woman with a baby, and the partner is Billy Jackrabbit. Puccini had no idea what Indians were all about, and the little music he does give them is totally inappropriate and wrong, because he just didn't get it. I mean, we're talking 1907, when most people had no idea. These, in fact, were the Miwok Indians who gathered corn, and they made meal out of their corn. This was their main staple. They helped the miners somewhat, but gold meant nothing to the Indians. But you know, it gave them a little money to live. So the Indians, the Indian girl and her baby are there. Minnie is getting dressed up in her finest dress. This doesn't happen to her very often. There's a knock on the door, and Johnson appears. They sit down. She sends Wokley away, and the two of them get to know each other, and of course fall instantly in love. They don't have a lot of time, but so as they're talking, suddenly there is a sound of gunshots outside. The men are seeking this Ramirez, and Rance is concerned about Minnie. He comes hammering on the door. He comes in, bursting in. Johnson has hidden quickly somewhere behind the curtains, or somewhere, so that he won't be found. And in the course of Rance's interrogating Minnie, because he's suspicious of her, he asks her, he tells her that Ramirez has had a girlfriend, Nina Milka Torena, who is going to tell them that night the whereabouts of Johnson. So Rance leaves, and Minnie now is a bit upset. There's another woman in the picture, so she turns and asks him what's going on, and he says, nothing's going on. He said, I will have to leave. So he prepares to leave, but not before they sing, of course, a love duet. It's a wonder. Puccini ramps it up here. I mean, as the storm is going on outside, the two of them are falling passionately in love, and you get this double effect of the storm and Johnson and Minnie falling in love. Perhaps we can hear a little of that.
Was the love duet between Minnie and Dick, and we heard gunshots.
Yeah,
outside
the men, Rance and the miners are looking for this bandit that they believe is in the vicinity. Finally, they leave, and Johnson says, "I have to go too." And he leaves after they have a bit of a row because Minnie confronts him. "Who is this Nina that Rance told me about?" And he says, "I just have to go." So he leaves the cabin. The door opens, and the snow blows in. That's one of those stage effects. And there's a shot, and then there's a thump against the wall. He has been shot, and he falls on her doorstep outside the door. So she drags him in, and he's been badly wounded, and she helps him up into the attic, up a staircase into the attic, and because Rance again is returning. Rance insists that that Minnie is having a relationship or a friendship, and that she's shielding, she's covering for Johnson. And they're having this argument when suddenly a drop of blood falls on the sheriff's hand. And he looks up and he looks into the rafters and he realizes at once Johnson must be hiding there. So he orders him down. Minnie helps him down, takes him to the table, and Johnson collapses. He passes out over the table. This was actually this sounds so far-fetched that they could happen like this. But apparently there was at some point a sheriff who walked in to one of these cabins where the men were playing cards. And let me quote you. This is a little piece that Puccini actually used in this opera. "The miners let him win cards so as to make him feel good. But as he held out his hand to say good night, a drop of blood fell upon it. The victim was caught. There was no staying the hand of the law. One could see this very well as the sheriff gripped his gun and drew himself up to his full height. Standing there, his gaunt shadow thrown against the wall, his white face etched with marks of hardship and of toil, he poked the muzzle of his gun between the rafters and fired once. He had done his job, and so he left without another word." That really happened.
That's amazing.
Now, in the opera, what happens is that Minnie realizes that the game is up and things are looking really bad, so she has an idea, and she says to Rance, she says, "Why don't we play a game of cards? Whoever is the winner of 2 out of 3 hands of cards gets Johnson. If you win, you get Johnson and me both. If I win, I get Johnson." So he's a gambler. He can't resist this. So they sit down and they play this incredible card game with Johnson draped over the table. Rance wins one hand, she wins the next one, and then the third hand is dealt, and he jumps up exuberant. He said, "I've won." And Minnie has this fainting moment. This is not a woman who faints normally, but she has this little fainting moment, and she says, "I need a glass of water." So Rance goes to get her a glass of water, and as soon as his back is turned, she slips cards out of her garter and puts them on the table. And he comes back and says, "I'm sorry, you are so upset that you lost." She said, "No, I was exuberant. I won the card game." And she shows the hand, the winning hand. And Rance, who is one of these strong, silent types, except he's a tenor and he's in. He bows to her gracefully, goes to the door, and he leaves. So Johnson has been saved. Let's play a little of the card game.
She's been saved through gambling and cheating at cards.
Yeah, exactly. You know, she plays the game the way they play it. You play with the cards you're dealt in life, right? So it's a marvelous moment. It's very tense. I'd like to play a little of the card game. You'll hear there's almost a silence. In fact, no music can be so intense when there's nothing happening and you're waiting for something to happen. You'll get a sense of that in this excerpt.
Buonanotte.
So there's plenty of high drama in this opera, La Femme Julie Del West. It's straight modeled on the westerns of the early, you know, the early part of the century. The final scene then is also dramatic, of course. It's out in the open near the Polka Saloon. The miners have managed to capture Johnson. He did have to leave the cabin, and they capture him, and they're all for stringing him up. Rance appears. He's absolutely delighted. He's now going to get rid of his rival, and they put the rope over the tree and the noose over his neck, at which time the tenor sings the one beautiful aria in this opera about that he had murdered no one and that he had loved Minnie, and that Minnie should not be told how he had died. The miners were just simply to tell her that he had left and ridden off. At this point, at the high drama, when they're just about to kick his horse away or whatever from under him, Minnie comes storming on stage, and in some productions brandishing guns and riding a horse. That's very effective.
They'll bring an actual horse onto
the
stage.
I've seen this with two horses. Johnson's in Utah. The Utah Opera was run by Glade Peterson, who was reared on a ranch in Utah, and who would ride his horse on stage for Johnson's entrance, and then at the end Minnie would come on with a horse, guns blazing. I mean, the whole thing. There's no horse in this production, sadly. I love that. But she comes and she stands in front of Johnson. She defies the miners. Rance wants them to kill him. She says no. And then she turns to each one, reminds them of that biblical line, there is no sinner who is too great that he cannot be redeemed. It's a very Wagnerian theme. I mean, Wagner's operas were all about salvation through love, the redemption of a man by a woman. And here it's happening again. Puccini was much influenced by Wagner's work and the grandioseness of this score and in this theme at the end. So she turns to each of the miners and she reminds them of the little shared confidences that they had had together and all the things she had done for her. And they turn to her. They say, "You are an angel from God, and we'll let him go." So they let him go, and the two of them then walk off into the sunrise in this opera in true Western style as the opera ends, with a happy ending for a Puccini opera that's in and of itself sort of unusual.
And you thought nothing could get more dramatic than the card game, but the near-death experience.
Yes.
Hanging and then riding off or whatever into the sunrise.
Into the sunset. It rises. You know, the excitement, the adrenaline, it lifts as this opera goes from one place to another. And it doesn't end in tragedy. They leave. But even leaving is poignant. He leaves everything behind to go with Minnie to find a new life where no one knows them. She has known nothing but the mountains in this life. She's leaving everything. The miners are losing their Minnie. For them, his greatest crime is taking her, not the fact that he is a bandit or about not to be a bandit. And Rance is left. Rance is not an evil character. In his way, he loves Minnie. He's wildly jealous and angry, but he plays honorably. He's a gentleman, I suppose, in some sense of the word. So the last piece of music perhaps we could play is some of Johnson's aria at the end, where he thinks he's facing death before Minnie comes to save him.
Spera, io torni, e passi.
That was Placido Domingo singing Dick Johnson in La Fanciulla del West.
And a happy ending, and it sounds like it's going to be a wonderful production. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the production.
The production is one that received extraordinary honors and acclaim when it first appeared in London in 2014. The director is Richard Jones. He's an Englishman who has kept it pretty well in the time period, though he's upped it a little bit in that there is electricity and there would not have been electricity in those early days. But you can't change that setting too much. It is the mining shack, and you have a sense of the great trees and the forest that surrounds it. Richard Johnson is the director. We have a wonderful mini. Patricia Rossette is a very popular singer here.
Yeah.
She's never sung mini. Mini's a very challenging role. All the singers say, you know, you hesitate before singing Puccini's La Fanciulla del West. She'll be superb in this, I think, very sympathetic, and she certainly understands the West. Her Johnson is Gwyn Hughes-Jones, and Mark Delavan, who's been here many times, sings Scarpia a lot in Tosca, is singing Rance. So it's a strong cast with, of course, the wonderful apprentices will become all of these miners, each with their own stories. But so that's something to look forward to. There are many performances, and tickets can be easily acquired by calling the box office.
Now, let's go back to the beginning and how this got. I mean, I just find it so sort of like sweetly amusing to hear a Western story sung by Ciao Ragazzi and things like that.
Especially where we live, you know, here in Santa Fe, being in the West. Yeah,
we're in the West, and we're listening to them do this Western thing in Italian. And like all operas, it's very stylized and not supposed to be realistic. But tell us a little bit more about the process of going from that play in New York in 1907 to this opera.
Yeah, it took about 3 years. When Puccini got permission to produce it from David Belasco, going through Ricordi, the music publisher who he worked so closely with, his first librettist was Carlo Zangarini. Now, Zangarini seemed to be appropriate because his mother had been born in Colorado, so he would have had some feel for maybe the language. That was what Puccini hoped. But Zangarini never really came through with the libretto. Puccini was a terrible taskmaster. I mean, he asked so much of his librettists. A librettist being the person who writes the little book. A libretto is a little book. It's the text of the opera that he took from the Belasco play. You sit down, you take the play, and then you take maybe some lines directly from the play, but you shape it. The role of the librettist is to shape the play so that it can inspire the composer to write music. That's the sort of the process. But Zangarini wasn't coming through. He just wasn't getting it to Puccini, who then hired Civinini to complete it. And it was sort of a battle throughout those years, apart from the fact that in the middle of all of this, there was a terrible hiatus in Puccini's life. His home life was chaotic. He was married to a woman who was very jealous, with good cause. Puccini had a few girlfriends, and she believed that the servant girl in the house, Doria Manfredi, had a relationship with Puccini. They both denied it, but she was so virulent in her criticism of the young woman that she was fired from the house. She spread word about her through the village that she was an evil girl and that she'd been having this relationship with Puccini. He absolutely denied it. And it was so bad that Doria took poison and died. She killed herself.
Oh, my goodness.
It was that bad. So he had to stop everything, the opera, nothing. He couldn't get to work. He had to deal with this. And it became very serious. There was a court case, and Elvira, his wife, was to be sent to prison. And the family finally settled with Puccini. He had to pay a fortune in order to do it. And he broke with Elvira for a while. But this was a man who was very dependent on this wife, and ultimately he went back to her. But that crisis, the Doria Manfredi affair, happened in the middle of composing this opera.
You can imagine
the pressure. So at the same time, he's pouring a lot of this onto his poor librettists, Zangarini and Civinini, and the whole thing culminated finally in a premiere at the Metropolitan Opera in 1910. There were 55 curtain calls. The American audience went crazy about this piece. It was an extraordinary success, and it was seen in something like 9 countries within 2 years of the premiere. But that was us the process of how Puccini worked, took the play, gave it to his librettist, two of them, and they finally came to performance in 1910.
Can I just point out that Puccini worked with Zangarini and Civinini, and then it was conducted by Toscanini, and afterwards
<That's right. laughs>
they went out and ate panini.
Yeah, of course. You don't need a lot of Italian. So
a wonderful opera, and I have to say, no wonder he wrote a happy ending. I mean, considering everything that was happening in his life, he had to do something.
Yes, maybe. Who knows why? I mean, most of Puccini himself said, I'm a little tired of all these dying, suffering heroines. I mean, he'd been dealing with Madame Butterfly, with Tosca, who jumped off the parapet, with Manon Lescaut, who dies in the deserts of Louisiana. There are no deserts in Louisiana.
This Minnie is competent, tough, vulnerable, appealing.
Wonderful.
She's just, there's nothing wrong with Minnie.
No, she's a little naive, but she's on top of things. She's uneducated, but she knows what's important. And she loves nature, and of course she falls passionately for the first time in love with this bandit Dick Johnson from Sacramento. So go to see that. It's a great evening. I mean, I promise you, everything else that's going on in your life will go straight out of your head as you sit and watch this. It's that extraordinary house that we have here, the Santa Fe Opera. It's so beautiful. It lends itself to this because as you look outside the theater, you're seeing the rolling hills. I mean, we are at 7,000 feet, which is probably as high as the Sierra Nevadas. It could be an extension of our theater.
And you can almost imagine somebody riding up on a horse at
yes.
the end. Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us today on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number in Santa Fe is 505-986-5900. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.